Louis, today I would like to talk about racism. And I recognize that this is not an easy topic to address, but I think in Salmon Arm we are constantly wondering how we can do better at addressing racism and eliminating racism. So I have some questions for you today, which, you know, I'm so appreciative of how generous you've been, and we can discuss how much you're comfortable talking about. But one of the things that I've learned is especially from Bob Joseph's books, is that the Indian Act is a racist document. And there are so many things that are actually built into our system that are so racist, and that those are important aspects to address and to try to break down. So that's what I want to talk about today. How do you feel about that?
Go for it.
Okay. So the first thing I'd like to do is actually just read a paragraph from Bob Joseph's book, Indigenous Relations. And if you haven't read 21 Things You Didn't Know About the Indian Act, I highly recommend that one. This is kind of a follow-up to that. It's insights, tips, and suggestions to make reconciliation a reality. But here's what he says. The term reconciliation carries a great deal of responsibility for a better future, but it also points to the need to recognize the shameful history of Canada's past relationship with Indigenous peoples, as well as the ongoing outcomes of those policies. The path to reconciliation began in 1982, when the rights of Aboriginal peoples were recognized in Section 35 of Canada's Constitution Act. The next milestone on the journey was in 1998, when the federal government made the Statement of Reconciliation, thereby acknowledging government-inflicted damage on Indigenous peoples. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission released its final report. The first volume is titled Honoring the Truth, Reconciling for the Future. The report, based on the statements of tens of thousands of survivors, shocked many Canadians, who then asked, "Now that I know, what can I do to help right these wrongs?" The TRC's final report included the 94 calls to action, guidelines for moving forward together in the spirit of reconciliation. The calls to action cover many sectors such as education, media, and sports. And the 92nd call to action focuses on how respectful business dealings can contribute to reconciliation. So the reason I wanted to kind of read that little part is because I think the business part of this is a key aspect to how racist policies and racist actions and habits have persisted in Salmon Arm. If it's okay, I would like to talk a little bit about some of your experiences with that, either way in the past or in the recent past.
Well, growing up in Salmon Arm, even then we're still a minority, you know, because of the influx of the settlers. And naturally, we weren't familiar with their ways. But I think we got kind of along, because they needed to learn how to live in this land. So there was a little communication back then. I think it was the early settlers' way of learning how to live, to exist in this land. Of course, they needed a lot of our help to clear the land to do their farming. Once they got settled in, started bringing their school system in, their stores, and by then we were starting to being kind of assimilated. You know, we couldn't go off the reserve or hunt or gather anymore. Things were a little bit different back then. And maybe we were still looked at as dirty, stinking Indians, which I was referred to a few times when I was growing up. And quite a few of the stores wouldn't allow us in there. That's the same with my mother when she was having my twin brothers a year younger than me. They rushed her to the hospital here and said, "We're sorry, we don't accept natives here. The only place that would be Enderby." So they rushed her to Enderby, where my twin brothers were born. There was a lot of complication because at that time, a lot of our people were, I think just about everybody was born at home back then. You know, they all had midwives. And I was one of them. I was born in a woodshed. We weren't allowed to be to be born inside of a house because of the taboo around blood. So the only, when I was ready to be born, I was put out in a woodshed. And that's where I was born, saying, had old Dan and Harry, my horses, and we had some cows, a few cows, and all watching me being born at them, just like I had a manger. And so there was a little bit of racism back then because, you know, we were the minority, but I think we actually accepted it. You know, we knew where to go and where not to go. It took a while, you know, after a while to understand where we were allowed and where we weren't allowed. Some of the stores wouldn't accept us natives in there. So it was a learning experience, you know, and even going to school when we first started. And my brothers, my older brother and sisters were the first ones to go to public school back in 52, 53. And we were a minority there too. But I think that all in all, I never spent much time in town anyway. Because in growing up locally here, I spent all my time outdoors. We were up in the hills or down by the river, especially down by the river all winter long and all summer long. We were camped down there, so we never really came into town. Only on weekends was a big thing to go to the Selmar. And we were only allowed to sit on the left-hand side. Natives weren't allowed to sit on the other side, in the middle or on the other far right side. Every once in a while we'd sneak over there and be rebels. But you know, it was some things we learned to accept. We didn't look at it as racism back then. But you know, it's just the way you grew up, I guess. You know, you knew what you could do, what you can't do. So now they call it racism. But me, I call it this kind of growing up in Salmon Arm and understanding their local rules. So, but now when you look back at it, I guess it was racism, but I still don't look at it that way. I think it's just a matter of understanding each other. And I think that's why a lot of people don't come on a reserve. Maybe they're scared to get scalped or whatever. You know, because a lot of people are scared to come on a reserve. It's like our people now, they're scared to get off the reserve, so.
Well, I remember we did the cultural mapping project with 2S LGBTQ folks in Salmon Arm talking about safe spaces. And what we learned in that process is that there's no such thing as safe spaces. There's only safe people. And people make spaces feel safe. But it's a very energy-draining process to have to navigate your way every minute of every day into places that you can feel safe. And knowing where you're not safe and knowing where you're safe is just, yeah, it's just something that most settlers don't have that experience with. They don't understand that.
I guess the city's pretty well my safe space now, but I think very few of us come into town because, you know, maybe we feel like we still don't belong yet. But I worked hard at acceptance. When I first, like I said, when I first got on council, I didn't know anything. So I used Salmon Arm as my college, you know, to learn of what's going on outside of our community. It was difficult at first. My growing up was in the other side of the tracks, so to speak, growing up on the wild side. And so I started using Salmon Arm as my college, understanding who they are and what do they do. And I think that, to me, it kind of opened my eyes a little more and starting to be able to communicate a little more because I couldn't talk to anybody when I first introduced myself to the city. No, I feel a little more confident when I talk. And I didn't do public speaking for the longest time. I was glad of my mother. She done all the public speaking. I just did the work in the background, learning more of the ways of so-called white settlers. I think in that process, it gave me a better idea of how to work together. But that's an individual thing. It's not a thing they do with our people. I think our people still feel unsafe, not unsafe, but of coming out of that reserve. I'll say that they put a big steel wall around or wire cage around our reserve. Our people are scared to get off and the people are scared to go on. So I think that to me it's a barrier that maybe one day might come down, but I think it still sets us apart though as Suwakmuk people though. But I think that if we're going to do anything that involves the land or something, we got to learn how to work together as people, not as Kalmu. And I think that one day it might come and maybe it takes a crisis for us to work together.
Are there any cultural teachings about racism that is about the other, right?
You got to remember there was no, we were the only ones here with the animals. So
yeah.
How could we have cultural teachings? About racism, especially when we got along good with all the animals and the plants and everything, because we looked after them and they looked after us. So how could there be racism? And it wasn't taught at home, because the kids learned the right way growing up. So how could they do anything bad if they were only learning about the good things? It's that one there. I've never come across anything about racism. It's about the coyote and all the animals telling their story and how do we... I think it's mostly about how do we survive in this land. Mm-hmm. All the morals of the Chiptakul are about how do we survive in this land, teaching us, all the animals teaching us how to live on this land harmoniously, so the word is saying.
So how do you feel about how Indigenous people are portrayed in movies and TV shows?
Growing up, I always laugh about that. And we used to go in town to watch the movies. There's one incident I've got to talk about. Jerry, when we went in there, a bunch of us kids went in there, and then Jerry's first time, my brother Jerry's first time in the movies there when they had that big MGM line come in. Donnie's roaring. Jerry took off in a hurry. I think my grandfather was outside to walk him home. But yeah, it's because we used to watch the old movies way back then about the cowboys and Indians. And when we used to go and play, it's ironic though, you know what? Nobody wanted to be the Indian on our reserve when we played cowboys and Indians on the res. Everybody wanted to be the cowboy because they're all portrayed as the good guy and the Indians were portrayed as the bad guy. Now when you look back about it, it's kind of a little bit funny. It was just the way the movies were. The Indians were always out scalping people and shooting their bow and arrows and killing all the white settlers when they're moving in and scalping and kai-eyeing around. I still see some of those old movies and it brings back memories of when I was a kid not wanting to be an Indian because they were bad people. So that was part of the indoctrination that maybe that's why people don't still come on the reserves, because they're scared to get scalped or shot with a bow and arrow.
You've been an amazing bridge builder all these years, honestly, going into all of these organizations and systems and governments to help build that understanding. But we're kind of miles apart still.
You aren't kidding. Well, I've had some trials and tribulations. I think how it started my work in the community was years ago when I first got on council. And people are saying, well, I didn't know how to act or do anything, and they told me, well, I asked my people, what am I supposed to do? You know, you're supposed to go to these meetings and get to know things. Yeah, big meeting in Vancouver, Prince George, all over the place, you know, they get a big fancy hotel and, yeah, get to go around, travel around in the big city, which I've hardly ever done. So I'd walk into a conference there looking pretty important, me and my little briefcase, hey, I'm a counselor from Salmon Arm. But nobody listened to me. And I started understanding that, you know, because I didn't really know anything. Well, I figured a good leader should know a little bit about everything. So I sat up in my little office on the reserve there for about 2-3 weeks, wondering, what am I going to do? And I looked around us. The economic development is all around us, you know, so that would pretty well limit us to what we could do on our land. So I figured, well, maybe if I introduce myself to the city and somehow understand what their way of thinking, because all my life I've lived on a reserve, so, you know, my ideas were really limited. So I introduced myself to city council, and next thing you know, I started joining groups. I think the environmental committee was one of the first ones. I was on the social planning committee. I was on the college advisory board and community futures. I was invited to Community Future to sit on their board. Then health-wise, I was with what they called New Directions, I think it was called. They were just transitioning the current health system right to what it is today, so I was on the steering committee for that one. So I pretty well sat on every group in town, you know, just getting understand more about what current life was all about. And I think that's where my understanding became more and more clear. You know, I could fit in and know in any conversation and know a little bit about it. And so I think that was a part of it, and working with my mother, and because she had the same idea, and you know, how do we work together as a community, not as Suwakmuk people, but, well, we are Suwakmuk people, all of us, because it's called Land of the Shuswap. So naturally, anybody who's living in Suwakmuk territory is part of the it's part of the land. So we're all Suwakmuk, we all belong to Suwakmukulu.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the idea about working together.
Did you feel welcomed at those places?
Well, it took quite a while because, you know, they had to get used to me and I had to get used to them. Because that was the first time I think anybody really got involved with the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a challenge.
And when was this? Like, who was mayor at the time in Salmon Arm?
Oh, I can't remember now. It was about 50 years ago. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a, you know, when I look back at it now, it's not about titles or anything. I think along the way, you know, it was the friendship I've created out of it. You know, I got to know a lot of people, and difficult trying to mix the two cultures together. A lot of people can't understand yet who we are. They still kind of struggle with it. You know, I tell them I talk to plants and I talk to animals, and people can't understand that. Being I'm a Klotawatla, the Suwakmukulu, Kopapas Waiditlikstam. You know, what I said was, you know, our people looked after this place for a long time, for many centuries. now everything is disappearing. You know, all our fish are gone. All our game is gone. All our trees are gone. All our plants are disappearing. So what does that do to our culture? You know, we try to get it back. That's why a lot of people are asking us what they did. You know, now they talk about wildfire. And what are people done to control burning? You know, different things like that. Now, and all our medicines, that all went out because they didn't want our people practicing medicine because it was work of the devil. Now look at all the medicines that disappeared with our people. Now people are asking us, well, what did your people do a long time ago? When we don't have the answers anymore. So that really makes it difficult now. I'll say, well, their assimilation program worked pretty good. You know, and but I'll just talk about that, you know, where people can't go out and because all our plants are disappearing. I told them, that's why we go hunting and gathering now at Askew's, Frills, and Walmart. And now, when you look, think about it, it won't be long now that the bears will be taking their cart down to Walmart and pushing it down the aisle looking for food.
Can you tell us anything about your experience with RCMP?
I've had lots of experience with them. They aren't all good ones or all bad ones, but we played ball against them, you know, so we learned how to get along with them. And there's a lot of times, you know what, I think it's kind of like one time I was coming back from Chase. I was at a meeting over there and I got pulled over. And I asked him, why did you stop? He says, oh, I'm looking for impaired drivers. Just after I left, I drove on, how did he single me out as an impaired driver? Is that part of that, you know, all drunken Indians? So it really made me think about it. I should have asked him it back then. He said, well, how come you stopped me? But, you know, it didn't dawn on me until after I went down the highway and then realized, how come he singled me out? You know, so there are instances, you know, that there's still a perception that we're all drunken Indians. And I told him I've been sober for about 30 years now, and he let me go, but, you know, I think there's still that perception yet around that, you know, we're still dirty, drunken Indians yet, you know, and because one time my sister wanted a bottle of wine, so I stopped in the liquor store, and I got stopped around A&W, and I said, how come you stopped me? Yeah, I said, well, I seen you come out of the liquor store. I'm just buying a bottle for my sister. Yeah, I quit drinking a long time ago, so he let me go. So, you know, so I still think there's still some people's minds, you know, are still dirty, drunken Indians. You know.
So the fear of RCMP is very real.
That's been going on for a few hundred years now with the RCMP, yeah. You know.
Well, if I can share a story that I have. So we at the Gart Gallery, we've had an amazing relationship with a number of Indigenous artists over the years. And in one instance, we were doing installation and this artist asked me, or had to go to the bank and asked me if I wouldn't mind walking down to the bank with them. Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, no problem. And they just simply said, I'm just concerned that if the RCMP see me, they'll pick me up and I won't be able to contact my relatives. And it just, that particular incident to me helped me understand just a little tiny bit more how the justice system and the RCMP are deeply embedded in racist policies around justice in the prison system. So that fear of RCMP being lost in the RCMP system, it's visceral.
Yeah, I think it's slowly changing, but it's going to take a while like everything else. I know one time a bunch got caught in Chase and the drunk tank and joking around that one of the guys was the toughest guys on the reserve. Actually, he was the baby of the the band, and everybody just bugged him about being the toughest guy. And guess what the cops did? They took him in the back room and worked him over. Because they thought he was the toughest guy on the reserve. Oh. They had to teach him a lesson. Well, some guys thought it was funny when he did that, but, you know, that was the way we accepted things back then. You know, it wasn't racism, but it was part of growing up, we figured. But, you know, they had no right to beat him up because, you know, so-called toughest guy on a reserve. But after that, we learned not to make passing comments like that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's another very common racist myth about Indigenous people is that they don't pay any income tax.
Well, it's on reserve. If the business is situated on reserve, then we don't have to pay income tax there.
Right. If your employment comes from working on reserve, you don't have to pay income tax because the Indian Act declared it as personal property.
Yeah. And we're still under the federal jurisdiction, remember.
Yeah.
So provincially, they can't tax us on... But
if you work off reserve...
Yeah, we're taxed.
Yeah. You pay income tax like everybody else.
Anything we buy off the reserve, we have to pay tax like everybody else, you know.
Yeah.
Unless the business is what's on reserve. Even then, sometimes it depends on their negotiation with the chief and council.
Right.
Because some businesses... will pay the band, but you have to submit your own paperwork to the band to claim that tax.
Mm-hmm.
It's everybody figures that we don't have to pay taxes, we get everything for free, but like I said, you know, maybe move on the res for a while and...
You'll quickly learn.
Yeah. Because I think our single people get $180 a month on social assistance.
$180 a month?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it's around there, but it's not that much.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I think that's part of their assimilation program. They want us all to move into the city and collect welfare there because their bills are paid for and their housing is paid for, their rent is paid for, and whatever is left over, they can buy groceries with it. Whereas if you're on a reserve, they don't even cover your rent.
Mm-hmm.
Your social assistance is supposed to, but it only covers a small portion of it. And that's why our bands are getting, like I said, CMHC set it up as a failure. There are a lot of bands right across Canada owe thousands, millions and millions of dollars because we weren't working back in the day, you know, we could only accept small-ass jobs and couldn't afford to pay.
Mm-hmm.
It was a system that was set up for failure.
Yeah.
I think a lot of bands owe over $1 million each, so how many bands are there across Canada? So figure that one out.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to be like the plants, not talk and listen.
Mm.
And starting to understand more about what is out there. Because in our culture, there are Celtan, they're all our relatives, every living thing, even a simple rock is part of it. And it's getting to understand them more, because we've all lost that connection to the land. And I think our people are slowly losing that connection now. We all originate, I keep reminding people, we all originated living off the land to begin with. You look back at the stories behind it, you know, the early caveman. What did he live on? What did he eat? I think the European culture evolved rapidly. They ended up starting losing that connection to the land. Because when you think back of it, our people are still hunting and gathering 300-400 years ago, which is not that long ago, you know, in time span.
Mm-hmm.
We just had that loss of our connection to the land. And I think it's that understanding, get that understanding back. And slowly telling people, you know what? For thousands of years, our people existed in this, depending on the food off the land.
All the folks that are in the Swiss Mulf area, you feel like connecting back to the land is the answer, and understanding our relationship with the land.
Yeah, because I don't think it'd be too hard to bring our people back to it, because remember, it wasn't that long ago when we lost that connection.
Mm-hmm.
I think the need in there is still there. And maybe one day we'll wake up and smell the supalali or whatever.
Well, there's such an interruption in culture because of the cultural genocide of government and church practices over the last 150 years. So that interruption in cultural knowledge being passed down, the knowledge transfer, has been devastating. And so trying to regain that, like you just said, a lot of the knowledge is just gone.
Yeah.
Too many generations of harm have been done. Yeah. Now the challenge, especially as settler cultures are really interested in that land-based knowledge, how on earth are you expected to kind of reclaim and relearn your culture?
Well, I think there's too many gaps in there now. I've been involved in our culture for about 50 years now. And I keep talking about that because a lot of our ways are gone. I keep telling people, you know, our ways are gone, disappeared pretty well. When you look back at the way we did things back 300-400 years ago, now we can't do that anymore. And if we don't start looking back and sustaining ourselves, I think that to me, you know, it's getting scary out there. And I, not prophesizing or anything, but when you look back at our responsibility of looking after the land, if we really have to go back to that, I think we all have to go back to it, not just the Suwakmuk, the Kalmuk, or just the native people, but all the people. You see what's going on out there. All the fires, the flooding, you know, and earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes. You see that all happening now. Because you remember that we're Seltans, we're relatives of all the plants, the animals, everything. Hakayam is Ayapasyamiyatamiyuh. I said maybe the land is getting mad and fighting back now. Because you look at the fires that are going on, the flooding, the lack of water, everything. We're depleting everything. And how do we give back what we've taken? You know, it's like going to a bank, putting a bit of money in there, and you keep going in there with your little card, keep taking out money and money, keep taking it out. What happens when it's all gone? You know, how are you going to pay your bills? How are you going to buy groceries? How are you going to by gas?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same way was what we're doing to the land. We keep taking and taking from her. You know, you look at all the trees that are extracted, all the oil that's taken out of the land, all the gas, even the water. We can't live without water. And yet we keep depleting it. Well, it's not my problem. Maybe the government's problem. You know, we rely too heavily on the government. And what are they doing about it? You know, they're going to wait till there's a crisis. Then they'll start looking at it. I guess maybe we're a reactive society. You know, we don't look too far into the future. I think that's what our biggest problem was. Years ago, and we're looking after the land, you know, we accepted what was given to us. We thank the Creator for all that He's given us. Now we don't even do that. So, Hakayam is Ayapasyamiyatamiyu. I said, now the land is getting mad and it's fighting back. How do we replace all what we've taken? See, that's going to be a challenge for everybody, not just our people, but everybody in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a key to this, I think, is the gratitude, being thankful for what the earth has provided us. I don't know if many people do that, right? Go out and really understand how grateful we should be to live in this amazing area with the abundance of plants and animals. And I mean, it's an idyllic lifestyle that most people live here, and they're not grateful for it. They have so many expectations.
Yeah. Well, that's what I told the people up at Revelstoke, at Mount Revelstoke, the park up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're pretty proud of all their flowers and wild scenic up there. And I warned them, if you don't look after it, they're going to go away. You know, because our people went up there and harvested. They till the soil and let the other plants keep growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And all they do is they just let it settle, and the ground is going to get hard and they're going to slowly disappear. I see it happening all over the place. So they agreed, way back quite a few years ago to give us a harvest area up there to start looking after the plants, kind of, you know. Because when you go up there, you're tilling the soil and letting it grow a little better.
Yeah. Like what plants? Like, is that the...
The avalanche lily, chocolate lily, the spring beauty. I can't remember what else plants were up there. And I think those are the main, our main root crop they harvested up there. They followed it always from Chase right up to Revelstoke. And then by the time they got up there, it was pretty well time to move back to their winter area, so they slowly migrated back down. And so that was all part of it, you know, that looking after the land. And you got to remember too, when they're tilling the soil, when you really think about it, it kind of helps the, because you're getting rid of a lot of the grasses with the, when it dries up, you know, it creates a fire hazard. And when our people are tilling the soil up there, digging up their roots, actually they were making kind of fire breaks there. So, and I think we had so much water back then, you know, we didn't have to worry too much about forest fires because a lot of the crees kind of set up a barrier and slowed down the fire or went out by itself. And I don't think forestry really looked at what if there's any bad fires, you know, if it was so bad way back, maybe it would maybe all the lands, because we didn't have firefighters back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the fires would have burned thousands and thousands of hectares or acres way back then. So they found some evidence of controlled burning for huckleberries, so there was some of that. But when you look at it, it's even just a simple harvesting of our root crops all over the land, and it would have helped ease some of the grass problems. And a lot of the creeks were full, because when we talked about it at Mount Ida meetings or class camp, Mom was complaining about all the creeks disappearing over there, drying up. And those created barriers for the fire to slow it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more and more people are using, you look at from here to the coast, how many people actually use the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thousands and thousands of gallons. And so, see, that brings back, we keep taking and taking. How are we going to replace that?
Mm-hmm.
And water, I don't think it leaves the atmosphere. At least I haven't found any evidence of them right now. Nobody's really looked at it, maybe. But where does the water go?
Yeah.
It's still contained in our environment.
Rising oceans.
Maybe it moved somewhere else. Maybe it moved to China, or where they're getting real big bad floodings.
India. Exactly. The weather systems have changed, so yeah.
Maybe they moved over there. Give them grief for a while, and then they'll come back and give us grief too.
Well, I hope there's better balance in the future, but I mean, we're not dealing with it very well. We're not learning from Indigenous knowledge at this point about how to manage, you know, land gently and sustainably, right? It's about extraction, so yeah.
And how can we do it when we don't do it anymore?
Yeah. and how do we learn that if you know, we've made sure that the last 100 years that knowledge was driven out of Indigenous cultures. Like, that's the unfairness of it all, is that we all suffer, right? Like, it's not, I don't know. Anyway, that's a big conversation.
But, you know, when you think about it, you know, maybe that's why I'm here, to spread some of that knowledge and make people think.
Yeah.
I'm not the only one. There's other people out there talking the same thing.
And that's why, I think that's why I really wanted to address racism today, because I think that one of the things about white supremacy is that there's an assumption that somehow the white culture is the correct way, like the right way of doing things. And all it really takes is for us to open our ears and listen and understand that there are many ways of being, of supporting land, of supporting each other. There are many ways. We are not the correct way. And as a settler, I'm recognizing some of the ways that that has impacted not only Indigenous communities, but anybody who is not white. So I think addressing racism is part of that land recovery, because if we don't understand that there is other ways of doing things, then we're never going to try those other things. We're always going to just keep doing the same stupid things over and over again.
Yeah.
And taking and taking and taking.
Our people are mad. I know one time I did a talk up at the gathering place. And when I got up there, Ted Crouch was saying, "Oh, Louis, I forgot to tell you that this thing was sponsored by the 150-year celebration." I told him, "Well, you know, some of our people are mad about it because it's 150 years of colonization, they called it." So I had to give a talk, and I didn't want to offend anybody. I'm up there, what do I actually say? The only thing I could think of was saying, well, I said, some of our people look at the 150 years as 150 years of colonization. Me, the way I look at it, I think it's 150 years of getting to know you. So I kind of put a little twist to it, you know, to make people understand, you know, not all people are mad about the colonization. Of course I have every right to be angry, but I think I started getting to know people a lot more, and because you guys aren't all bad people. There are some good people out there. And, you know, it, starting a realization, you know, with my working with everyone in general, I think it's more acceptance than anything. I forgive you for your, you know, for your racism, your racist remarks, and what you did to me in the past. What's gone is gone. You can't replace it anymore. And it's thinking of all the good things. I think that was the way of our people. Only look, concentrate on the good things in life.
You once told me a story about the KKK in Vancouver making a statement about...
I don't know, I was reading The Province. I think it was in The Province or the other one. What was the other one? Paper. Back then there was popular Province, and but there was two papers. But one of them had a column in there mentioning that the chapter of the KKK was in Vancouver, and they wrote in their article there, "We got to get rid of all the colored people out of Canada." After reading it, I'm trying to figure out, where the heck are they going to send us? You know, I always wonder that, because a lot of times people will think or not think when they say something. And I think I'm guilty of that quite a few times in my lifetime. I think we all are guilty of that, but, you know, we never think. So I'm trying to figure out where they were going to send us, you know. And see, that's a matter of people saying, you know, without thinking.
Yeah. If anybody's ever wondered how it is that a government policy on Indigenous people can be racist, you should read the Indian Act. Now, this is where some of the myths come from, that because I was curious to learn about the myths and what was the truth, I did read quite a lot of stuff about this, but I found a really great little summary in Bob Joseph's book, Indigenous Relations, that I'd love to read. So there are some benefits for, these are his words. I do not like using the word Indian unless I'm referring specifically to the Indian Act, but Bob does use it when he refers to the Indian Act as well. So he says, "While there may be some benefits for status Indians under the Indian Act, there are far more disadvantages. Since its proclamation in 1876, the act has been used to replace traditional governing and decision-making systems with simple majority-elected all-male band councils, ban cultural events such as the potlatch, limit the indigenous land base from vast traditional territories to small reserves, eliminate economic development by prohibiting Indians from selling land, agricultural goods, or farm animals, prohibit Indians from investing monies earned by their communities, prevent, until recently, which is 1960, Indians from voting provincially or federally, limit the ability of Indians to leave the reserve, written permission authorized by an Indian agent was required, prohibit Indians from retaining a lawyer or raising funds with the intention of hiring a lawyer, remove Indian children from their homes and families to attend distant, government-funded and church-run Indian residential schools, and eliminate diverse indigenous identities by creating categories of Indianness. For example, status Indians, non-status Indians, Inuit, and Métis. Those are the only four categories of indigenous people. So that's just a little summary of the thing, some of the things that the Indian Act has in it and still has in it to this day that have not been changed, not been altered. And those are some of the policies that prevent us from moving forward in so many ways of reconciliation and addressing racism. So I just wanted to point that out, that this is not just from settlers moving into lands and taking over lands. It is so much more than that. It is built into the ways that Indigenous people have to live day to day.
Well, I think it's back then, I think it was called the Indian problem. Somebody was saying that I think it was a way of trying to assimilate us into the white population. Because every time Vincent, you look through history of government, you know, they always called us the Indian problem. Why did they give smallpox blankets out to the natives? You know, and different things like that. Why did they kill off all the chiefs or somebody up the anywhere? You know, because there were Indian problems, and how do we get rid of them? Mm-hmm. Assimilation was one way.
How does that make an individual feel? How does that make an Indigenous person feel when every time the government, the settler government, talks about them, they call it the Indian problem?
Yeah. It's only if somebody comes up and confronts me, that's when I take offense. But, you know, somebody else, you know, if the government release, I know, is there a way of trying to pass the buck, I think, and look at it differently, trying to convince other people, you know, the KK tried it and all the other groups have tried to change the way we did things for quite a number of years since they moved in. So I think we're still here yet, and it's going to take more than that to get rid of us, that's for sure. When I go up for my sweats, tell people I hear the laughter of our old people up and down the valley. Now I hear words of anger in many different languages, because now our communication is so rapid. You know, we could hear what's going on the other side of the world now, and I think that's where the anger comes in. And a lot of the racism that comes in with it, you know, because we all feel that we're the superior race, you know. And so racism is a two-way street. I think racism really started when the first settlers came in. You know, I hate to say that, but we started segregating ourselves. Originally, I'll say that, you know, when the first people came, they relied on us to exist in the land and to help clear the property. And I think that was the beginning of the kind of like the assimilation program they had. You know, it wasn't the government's fault, it wasn't the people's fault, but different people came in and started a new way of life for our people. And I don't think early settlers realized that, you know, the damage they were really doing to our culture, because we lived off the land. We traveled all over, hunting and gathering. Then when the settlers came in, they started claiming more and more of the properties in our traditional areas, and I think that's where a little bit of the anger came in, because we weren't allowed to go out and hunt and gather anymore, you know. So I think that then once the settlers learned how to live off the land, once their farms were cleared and they started maintaining their way of life, and the government wanted us to become farmers. And that's the hardest part when you look back the history of all the Native people across North America. They tried making farmers out of them. And, you know, they tell stories of Cochise and all those war chiefs trying to make farmers out of them when they relied on Mother Nature to provide everything for them. The only time they really farmed was when they went out to harvest their crops. And they relied on Mother Nature to water it and look after it that way.
But you needed the big areas, the big regions to do that, right?
Yeah.
Once the government started to parcel up the land and were giving big chunks of land to settlers and pushing indigenous people onto reserves, well, of course, you had not enough land to do that on. Mother Nature couldn't provide enough food on those tiny little pieces of land.
Well, when we started the meeting on Mount Ida or Glass Khan, all our elders were complaining about access to the mountain to look after it. They talked about the gates and the property all around it. They may as well fence the whole thing in. But it's ironic now that property owner shut off the really good access behind the graveyard. Now you hear all the settlers complaining or the other people complaining about access to the mountain now. So what really goes around comes around. They, you know, that argument that thing was brought up with our elders in the past when we first started meeting on Glass Khan. So, you know, what goes around comes around, you know. And they realized now what we were talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like that. All our harvest areas were taken up. Malacaw is a good example where people used to go pick low bush cranberries. Because I remember going up there when I was a young buck picking low bush blueberries up there. Now they got an industrial park over there and there's hardly any more blueberries. So I remember one time my kia was there picking blueberries and my little brothers were all dressed in black way back in the day. Here she was picking away, and I guess out of the corner eye, she seen that black, because my little brothers like dressing in black. She thought it was them picking beside her all the time. Here she's picking away, picking. Then she looked over. Here it was a bear, black bear, right beside her. She got mad. She chased it away. Never was scared of the animals, because, you know, closeness, I think, of our people yet at that time, you know, it was all part of, you know, because they belonged to the land like we did too. So it was quite an experience for her, because she thought it was my little brothers picking berries beside her. Here it was a little bear right beside her. But that's part of life, you know, and like I said, all our harvest areas are disappearing, and we're not looking after the land like we did a long time ago. And, so I think that, you know, we're supposed to be talking about racism, but I think this needs to be known why. I think that people have to understand, you know, our way of life was slowly disappearing.
Were you were you a young adult in the time when there were Indian agents? And you had to have permission to leave the reserve. Did you experience that?
No, by the time I was growing up, but I heard stories. You know, we weren't really allowed to leave the reserve unless you had permission from the Indian agent. And our Indian agent was in Kamloops, because I was looking at my granduncle's logbook. And it seems like that's all he was doing was buying groceries. He had receipts from buying groceries because I think that was, at that time, that was the chief's responsibility. And that was how they had to look after the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so our governance has slowly disappeared from that. So it's really difficult to say, well, is it the right thing? But, you know, it's... We always had trouble with the Indian affairs, and I think that's why they shut it down. People were starting to understand a little more, and they had an occupation in there and closed down the whole system over there. But, you know, we're still struggling with our self-governance because, you know, and...
Well, the band structure is government-imposed.
Yeah. Right?
So that's not the ancestral way.
No, you know, we're more democratic, you know. We, what I gather is that, you know, the whole community got together, whoever, maybe it was family community or whatever, they all got together and they decided what they're going to do. And the chief's main job was to designate people, you know, to do the job. It wasn't, you know... Yeah, my way or the highway. So they had a real way of working together.
Well, thank you, Louis. This has been an incredible learning day again. It's always wonderful to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge.
Yeah. Well, fun, all of you.
Oh, nice. Thank you.